So two observations that I have after our first 40 minutes this morning. The first is that it's always remarkable to me that whatever the VBS theme is and whatever character Tony is playing, it's an Australian accent mixed with something. So that's one. Here's the second observation. When Matt Huther was sharing his devotional thoughts and was talking about us being on the A-team, of course, my mind wandered off to Mr. T. You guys remember Mr. T from the A-team? I pitied a fool. Yeah, that guy. Then I was telling Ed Lovtinsky a couple weeks ago, I fell into a YouTube hole. You know what that is, right? The YouTube hole. Now, Ed's was really good. Ed said his YouTube hole is like DIY videos and then big machinery, and, you know, that sounds pretty good. My YouTube hole was watching Mr. T star in, not the A-Team, but the Battle of the Network Stars. Does anybody remember the Battle of the... Oh, yeah, you got to be a certain age. So thank you for the few of you that raised your hands. Yeah, oh, my goodness, Battle of the Network Stars. Well, it's good to be on the A-Team this morning. Yeah, Andy, right? It's good to be on the A-Team this morning. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to have our third conversation today from the Gospel of John. And as I've mentioned the first couple of weeks that I've been preaching from John, there are two things that I hope that we experience over the course of the rest of 2025. And this comes really out of our last year's reading of the chronological Bible. Again, I was impressed. It was impressed on me how much different the Gospel of John is than the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. About 80% of the content of John's Gospel is different than those of the Synoptic Gospels. And so as we are reading through the chronological Bible, that was really obvious, because we go through days at a time where we didn't have any readings from John, and then all of a sudden, John for two or three days in a row. And so that really captured my attention. And the second reason is because as I was reading from John, I was really struck by the picture that John creates of these two different parts of who Jesus is. Jesus being fully the Son of God, his divine nature, but Jesus also being fully human, the son of Joseph and of Mary. And it just caused me to see Jesus in a way that I feel like was lacking, in a way that allowed me to love Jesus more completely. And that is my hope as we continue to look at the life of Jesus through the eyes of the Apostle John, that you and I, in these brief moments on Sunday, would see Jesus in a more clear way, and that because of the clarity that we see Jesus with, that we will intensely love him for who he was, both as God's son, but also who he was as a human being. And we have a great example of that today, because we get to look at a story about Jesus being among the people that he loved, the earthly people that he loved, doing something that was kind and impactful on that audience, and really seeing the full display of both Jesus' divine nature and his humanity. If you're a believer in Jesus, then I know my primary point is not going to be earth-shattering to you, okay? My primary point today is that Jesus was the Son of God and Son of Mary, and you're going to say, well, of course he was. We know that. However, as I said, I want to just invite us to see in our text today and deeply appreciate this truth as if it were brand new to you. So I would just ask that you suspend some of the things that you know about Jesus and try to see him from a fresh perspective as the Son of God and also the Son of Mary. So let's look at our primary text. We're going to begin in John chapter 2. We're just going to cover the first 12 verses of the Gospel of John, and we'll look at a few other things this morning as well, but primarily John chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. So John the Apostle begins here. 3 days later, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. So if you remember back to last week, we talked about Jesus' baptism. And then after Jesus was baptized, what John talks next about is Jesus calling the first of his disciples. And we specifically see Jesus calling four of his disciples. We're not going to spend a lot of time covering that part of the text, but I do want to note that one of those four disciples that John talks about is the calling of Nathanael. And Nathanael is noteworthy because he was called by his friend Philip. So Philip was somewhere near Jesus, perhaps at Jesus' baptism, and Philip comes to realize that Jesus is the Son of God. He's the Messiah that the nation of Israel has been waiting for. And so what does Philip do? Philip does exactly what I hope you and I would do. If we were to encounter Jesus for the very first time in fleshly form right in front of us, Philip gets excited. And so he runs off and he tells, I presume, one of his best friends, Nathanael. And so Philip's telling Nathanael, hey, guess what? We just met the Son of God. We just met the Messiah. You got to come see what this is all about. And so I appreciate that Philip gives an example here of us not keeping Jesus a secret. And the first thing I want to do this morning is to encourage us, again, this is a little sidetrack. This is free, okay? This is not part of the cost of admission. Little sidetrack. Don't keep Jesus a secret. What a great example of the enthusiasm that we have when we really see Christ for who he is, for the first time or the 1,000th time, and being anxious and excited about telling others about Christ. That's what Philip shows us. So Nathanael comes along, and it's interesting to see what Nathanael's first response is. We see this in John chapter 1, verse 46. Nathanael says, Nazareth? Can anything good come from Nazareth? And so Philip says, well, you come. Just come and see for yourself. Primarily, the reason this caught my attention, besides the enthusiasm that Philip had, is that now, just a couple of days later, Nathanael is now going to be with Jesus. And what is Jesus going to do? He's going to go to a gathering with all these people from Nazareth. So Jesus is going to see his brothers, and he's going to see his mom, and he's going to see some family friends from this town, this really very small village in Israel. And Philip's going to get to meet the whole tribe from that terrible town of Nazareth. So we'll go on in our text here. Again, John chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. 3 days later, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, they have no more wine. So let's talk about this first observation in your outline about Mary's faith and her relationship with Jesus. It was the Jewish custom, the tradition, that a wedding feast was not a 10-minute ceremony like we have at New Life Community Church, like get up here, short vows, kiss the bride, go, right? And then something back here in the fellowship hall. This was probably a gathering for family and friends that had gone on for several days, maybe as long as a week. And so I'll ask those of you who have planned a wedding recently, maybe I can just, I'm going to speak to the moms a couple of times this morning. So moms, think back to when you planned a wedding for your son or for your daughter. Was anything about that kind of a nightmare experience, a little harrowing? I'm seeing some laughter right here. You're doubled over in laughter. What are you thinking? Nightmares, both of them, nightmares. Yeah, Mike and Kyler are going to be having their, I don't know, their second wedding coming up here in a couple of weeks, right? 2 weeks next week, right? Where's the rest of the Mullinex family? Here? Michelle, nightmare? Smart woman, because it would be a nightmare. Yeah. Well, it's challenging for us to plan for even, you know, a half a day where a wedding's taking place. Can you imagine planning for like the whole week? Relatives coming into town, multiple days of feeding people and having to worry about accommodations and all that kind of stuff. So that's probably the context of this story, that the wedding feast has been going on for several days, and we're likely near the end now of that festivity. And we've got a bit of a drama that's going to take place here. The wine is gone. Can you imagine? Now, again, you moms, or dads, whoever's paying for the wedding, okay? Those of you who are paying for the wedding, I've done this. You are trying to strike that balance between, you don't want it to be so cheap that you run out of stuff, but you don't want to spend so much money that you got a bunch of leftovers because your friends really aren't that important, right? So you're trying to find that middle ground, okay? So they have missed the middle ground. They have run out of what is arguably the most important ingredient to a good festivity. They've run out of the wine. And so here we are, and I imagine mom, dad, who's ever planning that wedding, is feeling absolutely horrible. Now, I'm guessing that the family of the bride or the groom is probably good friends with Jesus' family, because Jesus' mom, Mary, is made aware of what's going on. And that would have been a big secret. Like, if you're running out of the wine, you're not telling other people. You're trying to keep this on the down low. But Mary finds out, and so what does Mary do? Well, she goes and she tells Jesus. It begs the question, at this point in time, what is it that Mary knows about Jesus? I would argue not much. So we know that through the other Gospels, through the other writings of the New Testament, that Mary knows what has been prophesied about Jesus. She knows where Jesus is supposed to end up as being God's son. But up until this point in time, it would be my guess that Mary hasn't personally witnessed a whole lot of that. She has just known Jesus as her son. The one exception to that would be the story, you'll remember this, of when Jesus is 12 years old and he goes to the temple. And he's hanging out with the religious leaders, and he is teaching the leaders in the temple. Well, that would have been pretty miraculous, and Mary certainly heard about that because she's frantically looking around Jerusalem for her son. He's nowhere to be found, and they have that interaction of, Jesus, what are you doing? And he tells his mom, and she said, don't do it again, and they go home. But Mary wasn't there for that. Like, she didn't get to witness Jesus' teaching in the temple when he was 12. And I'm guessing between 12 and about 30, Mary hasn't seen Jesus perform any miracles. We'll look at some text here in just a little bit that will help us confirm that a bit. So, when Mary goes to Jesus and she tells him they don't have any more wine, what is it that Mary was hoping Jesus was going to do? Like, that's pretty obvious to us today, right? Well, Jesus is going to turn the water into wine. Do you think that's what Mary thought he was going to do? I don't know. I think probably, she probably hoped, maybe thought that Jesus was going to have some power to do something significant here. I don't know. Maybe she was just insinuating that Jesus needed to head to Hy-Vee to get wine. I don't know. But it appears that the first thing that Mary thinks about is, I got to go tell my son what's going on. Now, that tells us a little bit about Mary's relationship with her son. I want to talk to the moms here again for a moment. In fact, let's get some exercise. So, moms, I'm going to ask you to stand up. If you have a son, specifically a son that is older than 12, okay, moms, if you have a son old, Megan Setson was like, not yet. Okay, moms, now, if you are towards the front, I want you to turn and face the back. So Michelle, Tammy, okay, and then you guys in the back continue facing to the front. Moms, here's what I want you to do for everybody to see. If you've raised a son that has turned 12 years old, moms, you have seen the look. You know what I'm talking about. Your son gets to be about 12 years old, and something about the dynamic of the relationship changes. And when you ask your teenage son to start doing stuff, you get the look. All right? Now, moms, I want you to show your other mom friends and everybody else, I want you to show us the look. Let's see it on your face. What does the look like? All right, I'm seeing some indignation. All right, now, thank you, moms. Now, we probably have in our midst, not many, but a few boys who were 12 that aren't 12 anymore that are right here, and your mom is here with you. So, if you are a young man or an oldish man now who is more than 12 and your mom is here, would you please stand up right now? All right. Young men, you have 20 seconds to say to your mom, I'm sorry. Here's part of what I want us to capture from the text this morning. Jesus was fully a guy. He wasn't just God's son. He was Mary's son. And I'm sure that Jesus was never like outright disrespectful, because that would have been sinful, and Jesus lived a sinless life. But I do wonder if there were moments where Jesus might have given Mary, you know, the look. And I wonder even if in John chapter 2, as we see how Jesus responds to his mom, I wonder if maybe Mary isn't getting the look right now, okay? Because look how Jesus responds to Mary. This is verses 4 through 5. Jesus says, "Dear woman," not "dear mom," "dear woman, this is not our problem." Now, you might say, well, that's just like an error in translation. Like maybe the Greek says mom. Maybe, you know, John is, there's a picture here of more intimacy going on than what's allowed by the translators. No, that word in the Greek is the translation not for mom. It is it's more of a formal word that describes woman, okay? So Jesus responding to his mother, who comes up to him saying, "Jesus, they've run out of wine." Jesus doesn't say, "Oh, I know, mom. I really want to do something about it." Jesus says, "Woman, this isn't our problem." He gives her the look, okay? But Mary is undeterred. She goes on to say, after Jesus has told her, "My time has not yet come," Mary goes to the servants and says, "Do whatever he tells you to do. Whatever Jesus says, that's what you need to do." So, the relationship that Mary has with Jesus, really special and really significant. Mary has a faith in Jesus that has really not yet been proven out, I don't believe, in Jesus' first 30 years of her life. But nevertheless, Mary has a faith in the prophecy about who Jesus is going to be. And she has a belief that her son is a man that is in a position to help their friends. It's a beautiful thing that we can see about both the divine nature and also the humanity of Jesus. Now, Jesus' response to Mary, besides maybe the look, is interesting. Jesus says, "My time has not yet come." And it reminds us that when Jesus was about this age, and last week reading about his baptism, Jesus didn't become a baby who was then 8 and 12 and 16 and 20 and and gradually grow up and assume these different measures or different levels of responsibility for ministry. If he did, like, we don't see any of that. We don't see any significance to Jesus' life as a Jewish leader growing up. We don't see a significance to Jesus' life as a leader in his hometown growing up. We don't get any details about what Jesus was like during that period of his life. But by the time he now is ready to start his ministry, it's an interesting dynamic of some things being very gradual and other things happening really quickly. Jesus knows, I would imagine, when his mom comes up to him and says they've run out of wine, Jesus knows that he can do something to help out his friends. And Jesus knows that he can do something that would be showing respect to his mom. But I imagine that Jesus also knows that if he does this thing, his cover is blown. John tells us that this is the first time that Jesus has performed a miracle, a sign. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. As soon as word about this gets out, it's going to be a whole different world for Jesus. And I wonder if part of the reason that Jesus is saying to Mary, this is not our time, my time has not yet come, is that Jesus has some reluctance about what's going to happen next. I'd say if Jesus were any one of us, I would say that Jesus was nervous. But maybe with nervousness comes fear or anxiety, and I don't want to imply that Jesus either had fear or was anxious. Again, negative emotions born out of sin. But I think it's fair to say that Jesus might have had some reluctance because he knew what was going to soon come. He knew his life was going to be completely turned upside down. And that chapter of his life is going to be new to him. It's not something that even Jesus had experienced previously, at least not in the record of his life as we see it in the New Testament. Again, I think another example of the combination of Jesus' humanity and his divinity on full display. The next event that John is going to describe after the wedding feast at Cana is when Jesus goes to Jerusalem for the Passover. And when Jesus does that, he clears the temple. You remember Jesus walks in and the money changers are there and they're making a profit on the Jews that have come to Jerusalem because they need to buy their Passover animals for sacrifices. And Jesus walks in and he sees what's going on. He sees that people are being cheated in the temple, and Jesus clears the whole thing out, and he confronts the religious leaders there. That's what's going to happen next as John records Jesus' life. Jesus is going to clear the temple, and he's going to tell the people that are there in kind of some cryptic language, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And of course, what those people were probably thinking, which is even clearly defined in the text, is, what do you mean? Like, this took years and years and years to build. You're going to destroy it and you're like going to build it like that? Now, of course, we know that Jesus wasn't talking about the physical building of the temple. We know that Jesus was talking about himself as being the temple. And when that was destroyed, it would be raised up in 3 days. That's what was coming for Jesus after this wedding feast. So I want to just pause and ask a question here. I want to ask the question, what moments have you had like the moment that Jesus may have been experiencing here? You had an upcoming event that maybe you weren't thrilled about. I don't know. Maybe you feel that way right now in light of things that are coming up in your life in the next 20-odd days. Things that you're just not wildly enthusiastic about, and yet you have a strong suspicion could take place. When you're faced with those days that are ahead, how do you respond? How do I respond? we see in this moment in time what Jesus' response is going to be. And it seems to be a moment where Jesus, whether he was enthusiastically embracing the future or had some reluctance about it, it seems to be a moment when Jesus is going to resign himself to trusting the plan. There had to be a moment where Jesus had to trust the plan. You might remember that one of our primary points last week was that Jesus was the obedient Son of God. And when Jesus was baptized, what does God the Father say? He says, "This is my Son, and I am pleased with him." What was he pleased about? I think primarily Jesus' obedience in fulfilling the prophecy that all things had to come. And that's what Jesus is doing here. He's continuing to be obedient and to fulfill the prophecy of what needs to come. And so Jesus submits himself to the future. He submits himself to the plan. One question I would have for us is how willing we are to submit ourselves to the plan, no matter what it is. No matter what it is that God has in store for you and for me, will you submit to the plan? Not the plan of New Life Community Church, God's plan, his design on your life. Well, we go on in our story. Verse 6, standing nearby were 6 stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And when the jars had been filled, he said, "Now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies." And so the servants, as they had been instructed by Mary, followed Jesus' instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course their servants knew, he called the bridegroom over and said, "A host always serves the best wine first. Then, when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine, but you have kept the best until now." Before we go on to our last point, just want to acknowledge here, of course Jesus made a fine wine. We would not expect anything less. And I also want to express to those that are getting married here soon, so again, Mike and Kyla, Andy, Summer, I don't know who else is here, but bring out the best food last. Make us wait a little bit for it, okay? And then we'll think you're like Jesus, okay? It'll be a holy experiment. So Jesus does the miracle. He changes the water into the wine. And it's noticed by the people that are there. Then the Apostle John goes on to write that this miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time that Jesus revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him, and after the wedding, Jesus went to Capernaum for a few days with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. You see, I've got a few words on the screen that are highlighted in yellow. I want to talk about those for a moment and dig a little deeper. Again, this is the first of the miraculous signs that Jesus performed. And that explains a lot. So we were hypothesizing a few minutes ago, what is it that Mary really knew about Jesus? What did Mary see when Jesus was growing up? I think what this text confirms is that Mary didn't see Jesus do any miracles. All Mary saw was an obedient son. One like any other Jewish boy that was committing his life to learning the Old Testament law, learning the trade of his dad, and being a teenager. All those things that our boys experience as they grow up. That's what Mary saw with her own eyes. Not miracles. Not signs and wonders. This was the first one that Jesus had done. I think that's important for us to note. And by the way, if Jesus' mom had not seen those, well, Jesus' brothers hadn't seen them either. Jesus' friends hadn't seen them. Jesus' new disciples hadn't even seen those things yet. And so this miraculous sign was unique. It was special. Second thing I want us to note here is that phrase, miraculous sign. The word miracle, as it appears here in John's gospel, is not the Greek word. There is a Greek language word for miracle, but that word by itself actually doesn't appear anywhere in the New Testament. This word that is translated as miraculous sign really does mean more of the word sign. Not a miracle per se, but a sign. Something that we're supposed to pay attention to. In this case, what is the sign? The sign is something that's under the surface here. The sign, as we will see it in John chapter 2, but also in John chapter 4, and also later throughout the book of John, is that Jesus was really unique. He really was God's son. That was the whole purpose of these miracles, or as the Greek text really says, of these signs that Jesus is performing. So that we would see that there is something different underneath the surface about who Jesus is. The Bible scholar and commentator F.F. Bruce says that these signs were what was really the underlying reality of who Jesus was. Mary's son, but also God's son. What happens here is that we see a revelation, the word revealed, a revelation of who Jesus is. These miracles, these signs were designed to make it clear to people that Jesus wasn't just Mary and Joseph's son. He wasn't just the guy from Nazareth, as Nathaniel had commented, but that Jesus was God's son. Again, I understand that what I'm saying this morning to those of you that have been Christians and saved for a long time is not unique. You know this. But as I asked of us as we started today, it was to have a different filter, a fresh filter about who Jesus is. Can you imagine seeing Jesus do these things for the very first time? Can you imagine knowing who Jesus was when he was growing up? And not seeing anything particularly special other than he's a good kid who's obedient to his parents. Can you imagine seeing that Jesus begin to do the things that Jesus did? John goes on to tell us that these things that Jesus was doing were not only a revelation, but that they were also designed to help us see his glory. The word glory there in the Greek is the word doxa. It is where we get the word doxology and where we get that hymn, praise God from whom all blessings flow. It comes directly from this idea that Jesus' glory was to be worshiped, was to be honored. In doing these signs, one of the necessities of those was that Jesus' glory, his real glory, would be clearly revealed to the people that were around him. And it was necessary. We're going to look at that in just a minute. If this were a less formal account of things, and if we were describing these events purely from a human perspective, what we might say here is that this is Jesus' first time like showing out, showing off a little bit. Not in an arrogant way, but this is the first time that Jesus really shows what he can do. And there's a wow moment. There's a wow moment. I hope we don't miss that. The result is that the disciples believed. And because they believed, their faith grew. It reminds me a little bit, you seen the movie Elf? Any Elf fans in here? Okay, about half of you. I'm going to talk to the half of you who know, and the half you don't, you can go rent it next Christmas time. There's a scene in the movie Elf where it's towards the end of the movie, and Santa has arrived in New York City, and the sleigh is not flying the way it needs to fly, therefore Santa can't deliver the presents, right? And so the challenge here, the problem, the reason the sleigh is not flying the way it's supposed to is twofold. The first is that the engine is broken, right? But the second is that Santa refers to what's called the faith-o-meter, right? And it's the faith that Santa really is Santa. What this reminds me of here a little bit, purely from a human perspective, is that these abilities to witness the miracles of Jesus were like that modern day version of the faith-o-meter. Jesus had a very short period of time. Sam's looking at Jenny laughing back. I see you, Sam. Jesus had a very short period of time to raise the level of expectation and the level of faith that people would have in him from zero to 100. Very little time. John specifically records six miracles of Jesus, only six. There are a couple of others that we might say are miracles because there are times where Jesus predicted what was going to happen and then it did. So there was a couple of others that are fulfillment of prophecy. But the kinds of things that we think of as being miraculous signs, changing water to wine, healing somebody who's sick, raising Lazarus from the dead, we'll see that sometime later in the year. Only six of these are recorded by the Apostle John. So what's happening here as Jesus performs this and other miracles is the faith-o-meter is jumping up through the roof. And this is exactly what Jesus wanted to have happen. Jesus says this himself in just a couple chapters. In John chapter 4, John records that Jesus again came to Cana where he had made the water wine. And there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus had come to Galilee, he went to him and was imploring Jesus to come down and heal his son, who at that time was at the point of death. And Jesus said to him, "Unless you people see the signs and wonders, you simply will not believe." Jesus knew that the signs and wonders were important to people's belief about him. So this was the second of what John records as these miraculous signs of Jesus. And yet I want us to also know and see that these miraculous signs of Jesus were not seen and understood by everybody in the same way. In John chapter 12, verse 17, John says that though Jesus had performed many signs before the people, they were not believing in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, who had written, "He has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts so that they would not see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and be converted." Jesus' miracles, catch this. This is really the last significant point of the morning. Jesus' miracles were for those who God the Father wanted the miracles to be for. They weren't random. They weren't random events with random people. Jesus' miracles were for those that God the Father wanted the miracles to be for, the miracles to be seen by. The people that needed to see Jesus' miracles would see them. The faith that was needed to believe in those miracles would be given. And for those whose salvation was being given to, in these moments of seeing Jesus perform these signs, salvation would be received. That's what these miracles were really all about. God saving his lost children. Jesus was the Son of God and also the Son of Mary. And these signs that Jesus performed confirmed all of this to be true. My question that I leave us with today is this: what will you see? And what will you believe? The question today is the same question that it was nearly 2,000 years ago. You saw today what Jesus did at the wedding feast, as provided to us by John's testimony. Are you among those that God is calling to faith through the signs of Jesus? Has Jesus done something miraculous in your life? Is he doing something right now today that is miraculous in your life? If that is true, I would just ask you to see it and submit to it. Whether you accepted Christ decades ago, my question is still the same. Are you seeing the miracles of Jesus in your life today, right now? Not in a mystical sort of way, but in a real and genuine way where you know Jesus is right now taking care of me. If that's true for you, praise God for that. If you're only coming now to realize, I think Jesus is doing something in my life. I think Jesus is, through the testimony of John, speaking to my life through these miracles, then I would implore you, believe in what you're seeing. Know that it is Jesus. And that Jesus performed these miracles and is performing these miracles just for your benefit, so that you would believe. If you'd like Jesus to be your Savior, and you want to make that commitment for the very first time, you can do that this morning. We're going to sing a song here in just a few minutes. I'd invite you, if that's a decision in your life that you want to make, turn to the person next to you and share that. Come on up to the front and talk to me. I'd be happy to have a conversation with you about that right now today. We're going to sing this song, Lord, Now Indeed I Find, Thy Power and Thine Alone Can Change the Leper's Spots and Melt the Heart of Stone. We must believe that that's still happening today. In this moment, all over the face of the earth, Jesus is still changing lives. Jesus is still performing miracles. Let's take a moment to discuss a message with somebody near you, or pray if you'd like, and then Matt and the team will come on up and lead our final song.